Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Rodney Shakespeare. Regular listeners are very familiar with Rodney and the types of discussions we have on air. Today will be no exception. There is so much going on that needs discussing, and we've got a full hour to do it. We will cover lots of ground. Rodney, I'll let you jump in with where you want to begin. I'm sure our minds are on the same topics.
Big problem, Steve. I am looking at a list of 11 subjects. Of course, we could try talking quickly, but that's a bad manners for a start, and people do not understand when people talk quickly. Anyway, number one, I do a weekly program on Al Etteger TV English, and last Friday, I demanded that a man should be arrested. I pointed my finger at him and said, arrest this man and preferably send him to the Tower of London. I did not, Steve, go so far as to say cut off his head. I draw the line. But I certainly wanted him shoved in the tower. Now, his name is Dr. Nicholas Colostrum. Mm. And he's actually a rather significant figure. You see, our Prime Minister at the United Nations made a speech in which he talked about extremists who are the cause of all the trouble in the world. And amongst those extremists, Steve, are people like yourself who dare to query the official account of 9/11, who dare to raise issues about, in the UK, what was a government-organized thing, 7/7. And on top of that, these people, like a lot of your listeners, dare to raise the issue of attack after attack on Islamic nations. And Cameron made it clear that people who raise these issues are extremists. But worse was to come. At the Conservative Party conference, a speech was made by Theresa May, the Home Office Minister, and her speech was much, much clearer than the Prime Minister's. Her speech was that all these so-called extremists, basically, she was proposing the immediate implementation of what we would call the 1984 police state. Anyway, Nick Colostrum was on the program, and he and I debated and raised the issues, though we were well aware that at the end of the day, this was an extremely serious matter, and the United Kingdom government is starting to try to smash out all sort of opposition and is publicly threatening. And, of course, we know that the UK and the USA, of course, are spying on everybody. And the people needn't think that this isn't a serious matter. The threats are out there. And they came specifically from Cameron and Theresa May, and credit to Nick Colostrum, who then went to Scotland Yard, which is the headquarters of the police in London, and said that he was, in the Prime Minister's definition, an extremist. He was the cause of all the trouble in the Prime Minister's eyes, and that he must be arrested. Well, Steve, you will be interested to know that they refused to arrest him, and it's only me that's insisting that he should be arrested, and I'm not succeeding either. But jokes aside, Steve, a very, very serious matter.
And there are so okay. many. There are so many other matters just as serious, right, Rodney. And the people who are most should be held to account are the ones who get away with what they do and are allowed to keep repeating it. And ordinary people who harm so much. One of the things that galls me so much, Rodney, I don't want to change the subject. I want to let you stay on course. But when Israel attacks Gaza preemptively and commits what I call genocidal high crimes against peace and has the audacity to call doing it self-defense and to call a legitimate Palestinian self-defense terrorism, That gets me about as much as anything I can imagine. And, of course, the same is true with America's policy of wars without end, so-called humanitarian wars that really are nothing more than naked aggression, and they go on
okay.
and on.
Okay, Steve, right. Well, now you've mentioned that second one here, and that is also interesting in respect of the UK, because, you see, the truth about the genocidal attack on Gaza, which, by the way, has numerically is worse in eastern Ukraine, but we won't go into that for the moment. The truth of that has been getting out as a result of programs like Progressive Radio, Democracy Now!, Russia Today, Press TV, and Al Etiger English and Al Etiger Arabic. The truth is getting out there. And as a result, there was a most remarkable vote in the United Kingdom House of Commons, you know, our parliament, our lower house. And there, a magnificent majority voted in favor of recognizing a Palestine. Now, a whole lot of people stayed away, and they included our Prime Minister and Theresa May, because, you see, they didn't dare turn up in the House of Commons and say effectively that they've supported the slaughter in Gaza. And at the same time, they cowardly custards that they are, they didn't dare to stand up and say, well, Israel's gone too far and the situation is utterly preposterous, as it indeed it is. To be fair about the motion, Steve, it actually proposed the recognition of the state and of Palestine and a two-state solution, which, of course, is now physically impossible. And that is why perhaps the most independent of the thinkers in the House of Commons, who is George Galloway, MP, he voted against that motion on the grounds that a two-state solution is utterly impossible. If there was a two-state solution, the Palestine bit would be a tiny bit, and it would be a Bantustan, and worse than that, completely controlled and dominated by Israel. So there were some sort of ups and downs to the vote, but overall, it represents awakening of British MPs, and it's something on the scale of what happened a year ago, actually 15 months ago, when the public in the UK got hold of our Prime Minister and our MPs and said that they were not going to tolerate a war attack on Syria. You will remember that that was a false flag attack, as they all were, and it was done by the ISIS people, and with a poison gas supplied from Saudi Arabia. But there was Cameron standing up screaming for war. There was Haig screaming for war. And there was your two, Obama and Kerry, screaming for war. Well, okay, that was the public got stuck in. And they've also got stuck in now as a result of the genocide, other aspect of genocide in Gaza. So well done, a British public. Well done, British MPs. You've got a long, long way to go, and you haven't succeeded in changing national policy. But this is part, Steve, of an awakening now that Israel has gone much too far, and it gets away with it, basically, because the USA supports it. Like a sort of indulgent parent supporting its spoilt child forever, Israel carries on. But two things, not only Gaza, Steve, it's that 1,000 acres, yet have been just grabbed, and no, not a few buildings are being suddenly grabbed, more settlements, totally disrespecting international law, etc. Okay, so that was number two, a heartening development from British MPs, and Steve, it's going to get faster and faster, that one, because people have had enough with the grotesque killings done by Zionism. Okay, can I move on to Bahrain, because an interesting one there?
Oh, indeed, and I think I know where you're going, but I'll let you explain.
Go on, Steve. Where am I going on Bahrain?
Well, I think the daughter of one of the very, very well-known political prisoners will be prosecuted for, what did she do, burn the picture, a picture of the Bahraini king?
Yes, there are two sisters, and
two sisters,
they are the daughter of Mr. Al-Hawaja, who is a great activist, and who is ill in prison. I mean, it's abominable, the treatment. And I think it's the elder sister, Mariam. She went into Bahrain to visit her very, very ill father, and she got arrested for that. And then I think it's the younger sister now, who's, I don't know what she'd done, either torn up a piece of paper or something. But of course, the Al-Hawaja family will be arrested because they are amongst the leaders of a democracy. Now, Steve, I'm going to hold back for a bit, the bit I was going to open up with on Bahrain, and just tell you something else. There is, of course, a proposal for elections in Bahrain, and everybody is refusing to take, don't laugh, this is serious, but I'm laughing my head off.
It'll be something like America's elections.
oh dear, well yes. And these elections, and everyone is refusing to take part. And of course, they're refusing to take part, not only because the election will be rigged, but because there won't be any sort of seats, and there won't be any sort of power. This is in a country where the Prime Minister's been, nobody knows how many decades, but it's believed he's been in power. It's believed to be 4.5 decades, which I think is 45 years. You can work that one out. But at any rate, that's Bahrain, and the people are holding a firm. And Steve, I have a letter from the British Foreign Office which says, oh yes, they're always doing things about Bahrain, and they're talking to them. To our friends, they always say in their letters, meaning, of course, they're not going to stand up and do anything. But credit where credit is due. And this is what I want to say about Bahrain. They have actually done something in the last week or so, which is quite interesting. I mean, it's interesting to me, particularly because I am chair of the Committee Against Torture in Bahrain. And what that means is that I am the sort of the public figure, and one other person is known to be associated with that committee. That's Dr. Talib Warsi. And we're sort of the two public figures. But behind that, us, both of us, there is a network of people who beaver away and who get all the evidence to be used against the Khalifa regime. And when the time comes, that evidence is going to be used for criminal prosecutions against the whole damn lot of them. And that's what we're up to. Now, the news in this last week or 10 days is that Prince Nasser has had his diplomatic immunity removed. Now, the prince is a right one, a nasty piece of work. I'm really nasty. He used to put on a mask and go into the prisons and personally do the torturing himself, not just his regime, but this is his own little speciality. And on two occasions, the famous metaphor, the mask slipped from his face. Well, there's no metaphor. The mask did slip from his face. And that's why we are sitting on the evidence that we know that when we get our hands on Prince Nasser, we'll have a nasty criminal charge against him. Well, the British government has removed his diplomatic immunity. And this shows you what a lot of creepy crawlies the UK government is. We were saying that Prince Nasser, who had no diplomatic immunity at all, he was head of the National Guard, that's to say he's a thug, but no diplomatic immunity, but the British government, dealing with its friends, of course, had allowed him his diplomatic immunity, or so-called. But that's been taken away, which means that the prince will no longer be coming with his wife to spend money in the boutiques of London, where she can primp and preen in front of a mirror and think herself civilized. And he can go out to the gambling clubs with his mates. So that's a good sign, because it was done publicly, and there's just that little awareness now. Yes, Bahrain is a nasty place of torture. It is thoroughly anti-democratic. Hats off to the people of Bahrain, the most democratic people in the Middle East. And I just, if I may say, take the opportunity to say that the basic demands of the Committee Against Torture, apart from the fact that we're going to get them eventually, we, of course, demand the release of all political prisoners, the payment of compensation to those who have been tortured and to the families of those who have been killed. And then we wish to have a proper election with those who are elected having, in fact, proper power. And our advice to the killer Khalifa regime is get out now whilst you can, because, Steve, I'm not sure whether we're going to have time about to deal with this. Well, perhaps we can go on to it. But in fact, it's not on my list. It's number 12, I suppose. The Middle East may well be going into a sort of crisis. And because when it goes into crisis, you think things are fixed. For example, in Bahrain, people say, oh, Bahrain, that's where the USA has its fleet. There are 5,000 soldiers there and sailors. Yes, there are. And yes, the USA does have its fleet there, and it has another base in Qatar, and it has another base in Saudi Arabia. But, Steve, the whole of the Middle East could be about to go into complete and utter crisis, because you have a situation in which the USA, the UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia have created this monster. And they persuaded, goodness me, they persuaded Erdogan of Turkey to come in supporting this monster, and look at what is happening. A, the monster's got bigger, the monster's out of control, and look at what is happening in Turkey itself. They're lying their heads off, but in fact, the ISIL has not only got an office in Ankara, there are shops. They are succoring and harboring ISIS in every way they can, and they are stopping those who would oppose ISIS and trying to destroy the one regime in the area, but the only regime in the immediate area, which is that in Syria, which, by the way, if there was an election, would be elected by about 95% of the population.
Oh, well, Assad was re-elected in June with almost 89%, Rodney.
Well, Steve, you can go from 89 to 95, which another six.
Oh, indeed. And I made the point very strongly that the election was independently monitored and it was just open, free, and fair. Syrians simply don't want anybody else leading them but Bashar al-Assad. But you never hear a word about that in the U.S. media and so on and so forth. And I agree with you about the Middle East on a boil, where literally the entire region can become far more crisis-ridden than already running. It's a grave situation with the situation in Iraq and Syria, the Palestine situation, the Lebanese situation cross-border, where Israel shells cross-border whenever it wishes. We could end up with another war with Lebanon, the Egyptian government, that's nothing but a brutal dictatorship that murders its own people, allied with Israel and Washington, just horrible stuff. The situation in Libya, North Africa, just horrors going on in the North African Middle East area, and you'd never know it by the way things get reported in the major media. Of course, it gets reported in a convoluted way, Rodney. No information at all about the fact that ISIL, or I like to call them IS, Islamic State, IS, yeah, is a U.S. creation. And the same is true about Al-Qaeda and I believe the Nusra Front. And the names really are meaningless. It's America wanting shock troops or boots on the ground fighting its wars against the governments it wants removed. It did it against Gaddafi in Libya. It's doing it in Syria against Assad. And I don't know what the situation is in Iraq in terms of how America feels about the government. It got rid of the al-Maliki government, who was a U.S. stooge, but I guess he wasn't stooge enough, Rodney. So they've got a new government in, and I guess if it plays ball with America, it'll stay in. And if it doesn't, there'll be another regime change with somebody else coming in. But just how serious America is with fighting the IS fighters in Iraq, I don't know. But for certain, it's not doing it in Syria or along the border with Turkey.
Well, yeah, yes, and it is. The thing is, it is going into crisis, which is much more extensive than what it's getting out of control. And the Americans, of course, are in a complete and absolute muddle. They've created the thing, and it's just got out of control. But anyway, Steve, this will not only blowback is now happening in Turkey, but there's going to be, I prophesy, a blowback in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, of course, is right next to Bahrain. And Steve, if I can, there's so much to talk about. I want to add in a quick one about the crisis in the Middle East and then slip it down to Yemen. On the crisis in the Middle East, you've got to look at another factor, which is arising very, very rapidly. And it is this, and lies are being told about it. You've had a 20% drop in the price of oil. and everyone is jumping up and saying, oh, yes, look what that's going to do to the Russian economy. Well, I just say, yes, the Russians are, they have to borrow money from abroad. What a great big mistake. And they have to repay in dollars, and the ruble is under difficulty. But what they ought to do is capital controls in the same way as Malaysia did in 1998. But the point is this, Steve, is that into that Middle East situation, there is now that drop in the oil price. It may or may not have an effect on Russia, but the point is it represents a sudden recognition out there that the global economy is about to go into a lurch of what is a 15 or 20-year downward period. There was no real recovery from what happened in late 2007, 2008. Steve, the world debt, I've got some figures on another bit of paper, but I can tell you that the world debt has gone up 50% since 2007. We're talking trillions, by the way. I've forgotten how many trillions it is. The unemployment has increased. The rich poor division has increased. Nobody knows the figures, what the over-the-counter derivatives are, and you only need a few percentage of that, and the whole damn lot collapses. And what have you got? You've got an Ebola outbreak. And, Steve, there is a risk of war in with Russia, because, you see, when all else fails economically, they go to war. So in our pot, the mouth talking about the Middle East, we do have to put that underlying weakness of the global economy, which is suddenly reappearing again, and it could be that, and Ebola could be very nasty shocks, and Ebola is not on my list. Now, Steve, I did mention Yemen, and I wish, if I may, to draw the listeners' attention to northwest Yemen, where you have a Houthi movement. And it's very, very strange. Because on the one hand, Yemen is full of guns. On the other hand, the Houthi have been remarkably reticent about using their weapons, even though they were being slaughtered by basically a successor government to Saleh, who was the dictator who was booted out. But the successor government was basically reappointed by Saudi Arabia and the Americans. And the Houthi have taken over that northwest region, including the capital, Sana'a, and they're then slipping down the coast of the Red Sea. My guess is that that will probably be the limit of what is going on. But it is a revolution in Yemeni politics. At the same time, it is possible that the south and southeast of Yemen will go back to being a separate company as it was before. I think it was in 1990, somewhere around about there.
Yeah, it didn't seem too long ago, Ronnie.
Not too long ago. But this is all on the edge of Saudi Arabia. And I'm beginning to see that there are all sorts of things on there. Maybe it'll eventually be that blowback into Saudi Arabia. Of course, in Saudi Arabia, you just even put your nose up in the air and they will arrest you, whip you, or in the case of Sheikh Nimra al-Nimra, will cut off your head. He was just a Democrat. And the Saudis ruled simply just by picking you off the street and cutting off your head. But the blowback, which I think is going to come at the moment, ISIS is a vicious ideology. Of course, it's Wahhabist. How stupid that were the Americans, right? They support Wahhabism, which has been promoting now all the what inspires all those people who are going around creating ISIS, etc. How do you explain these young men who are prepared to die? They're dying for a vicious ideology which they think will improve their lives and improve the life of the human race. And it all comes out of Saudi Arabia. But that's the Saudis for you. And I think the blowback is suddenly going to hit Saudi Arabia. And, of course, that also will have consequences for that vicious autocracy in Bahrain. So I'm saying to listeners, keep your eyes out on what is happening on northwest Yemen, where there's been a revolution, and it really has not been reported in the Western media. How am I doing, Steve?
You're doing fine, and you're covering lots of ground. I know a little bit about some of these things. I know about the problems going on in Yemen and the fact that there was a prime minister appointed, and then he stepped down because the popular opposition opposed him. So it's really a mess. And of course, America's dirty hands are very much involved in what's going on there. One of America's indirect wars, Rodney.
Steve, you've gone.
Did you lose me?
You went away, but you're back again now.
I'm back again
count
now.
The
okay.
Five.
Okay.
Yes.
So I mentioned that Washington's dirty hands are very much involved in Yemen, and I consider what's going on there, what's going on in terms of long-standing turmoil over a number of years. The fact that it's one of America's indirect wars, as opposed to U.S. boots on the ground or bombing the way it's going on in Syria and Iraq.
Yes. Very quickly on Syria, I do hope that people have looked at the detail of Kobani, because amongst the blowback is not just the ISIS, which is going into Turkey. And remember that for many years, Turkey has had secular regimes with the army in control, and there's great secular forces in Turkey. But Turkey has declared war on 20 to 25% of its people, who are the Kurds. It's doing that by simply opening the people of Kobani to a slaughter. And, Steve, I've thought about this next remark, and, you know, I've said to myself, Rodney, should you make it? You know, should you really make it? Is it going too far? Is it unfair? But I'm very angry about the way the Turks are simply just saying, let there be a slaughter in Kobani. And by the way, what do you think Kerry, your Secretary of State, said? This slaughter is no concern of ours. This is these mates. So I'm going to make the remark, which is that when it comes to massacre, the Turks really are rather good at it. One thinks, for example, of the Armenian massacre. And now, essentially, they're opening up the Kurds to a massacre. So, I mean, I've had enough, I think, of Turkey. The only question is why did Erdogan change his policy? Was he bribed by the Americans? Was he blackmailed by the Americans? Or did they say that his wife or children would have a car accident? Or did they just say, you can be Mr. Big and you can expand in the Middle East? We will help you to do it. Because, you see, this buffer zone is all about Turkish expansion, if the Turks can do it, in the same way as Israel as threatening a buffer zone, and it's already in the Golan Heights, and it wants that little bit more of Syria as it tries to get back to what it thinks is its rights of a biblical state, which they claim existed 2,000 years ago. But at any rate, I think I've said it, the Turks aren't very good at massacres, aren't they? Okay, number six. Steve, I have to go on the European economy, and I have to go on Scotland, which has not died down. But on the European economy, and the two subjects are connected, you really do have to look at what is happening politically. Of course, behind this, the unemployment is getting worse, and all the lies are being told. But you only need any sort of deflation in the world economy, and God help Italy, France, Spain, and Greece. Their debt will become utterly unrepayable, and it's already unrepayable. And as a result, the political movement is, for example, in Italy, like 25%, the five-star movement, they want out not just from the euro, they now want out from Europe itself. Now, this, when you get these sort of figures, huge political change is coming. The whole structure is at risk and is even likely to be overthrown. That doesn't mean to say that those who have their little revolution know what to do, but they are fed up, and believe you me. And that was the big thing, which is, in fact, was behind Scottish independence. The Scottish vote essentially was against independence because of the elder people who voted in favor of the status quo. And then the younger people did not have quite that determination. And that was revealed by Alex Salmond, the leader of the Scottish Nationalists, who in the debate on independence stated that Scotland was going to keep the pound. And as soon as I heard that, I knew that the surrender flags had been raised. And I was saying to people, that's it, the surrender flag is up. Because, you see, if you don't have your own independent currency, then you are going to be controlled by outsiders. Russia at this moment is dependent on foreign capital and not uses its own capital. It's dependent on somebody else's creation by computer buttons at interest, and you have to repay it in somebody else's money. What a huge mistake. It hands control to outsiders. Well, as soon as Alex Salmond said that, I knew that Scotland had had it. But the reverberations of that movement are still going on. You see, because Cameron, the man who's going to lead the police state in the United Kingdom, Cameron, as part of the maneuvering to get people to vote against independence, he promised there would be a referendum, and he also promised that there would be increased powers for English MPs and increased powers for Scotland's powers as it is. Now, that means that the issues about independence and the powers of the parts of the United Kingdom, they haven't gone away. And they're going to be big stuff in the general election and in the period after. And so I'm going to say to listeners that you may think it's all died down, but it's not died down, because the overall economic situation is getting worse. You're getting independent movements, not just in Scotland, but in the Fleming part of Belgium, in Saxony, in Germany, in the Venetian part of Italy, in Catalonia and Basque country, of course, in Spain. And everybody is restless because of the underlying and increasing economic crisis. But don't think that the Scotland issue has gone away. It's going to reverberate strongly. And I think that politically and constitutionally, all that's really happened is what is an ongoing constitutional crisis is simply going on, and that the apparent defeat of the Scottish independence movement is going to possibly accentuate some forces. Behind it, they're all pushed by economic failure.
I wrote one article on the Scottish independence vote, Rodney. I was very suspicious about what was going on all along. Edinburgh was aligned with London and being very much against independence. And, of course, the bankers just absolutely wanted nothing to do with it. And I honestly believe that if independence won, it would have been, a small miracle. It might have been a big miracle. I think, I don't know how the Scottish people really felt deep down, but I think the vote was rigged to be sure that independence failed. So no matter how the Scots felt, unless it was overwhelmingly to one side in favor of independence, it certainly wasn't that based on a lot of different polls, it looked like, the Scots could have been in favor of it by a small margin, so it's very easy to let the thing go down by a small margin and not have people be suspicious that maybe something rotten was going on. I don't know that it was, but I was suspicious all along.
But a lot of people have an uneasy feeling. If it was the United States, with you and your, if I may say, your electronic systems, and if you haven't got rid of them, then you're going to have more trouble. And you manipulate your electoral lists all the time. We have weaknesses in the UK, and people are sort of feeling restless. They can't quite pin down that something has gone wrong. Without any doubt, the BBC, Sky News, and the rest of it were totally biased with the government point of view. And there is this restless feeling we can't quite pin it down something did go on. Nobody yet has clearly said exactly why, but let that feelings stay there, and maybe the truth will come out in due time. Now, if I may now turn to briefly to the subject of sanctions. It's very interesting that in the discussions between P5 plus one and Iran, you get the European spokesman, who, by the way, is quite a thug in his own way. He sees himself as serving what he thinks are the basically the American position in Europe, and he's supposed to represent Europe, but he represents the American position in Europe. To be fair, he has softened his tone a bit recently, but today he was saying, oh yes, Iran has come to the negotiating table because of sanctions. Well, I don't think so. Iran has come to the negotiating table because, in a strange way, and it is not a perfect country, it is starting to give leadership to independent nations and starting to say we're going to break free from everything in the West. And part of that, we're going to break free from sanctions. It's come about because of positive attitudes in Iran. The election of Rouhani, I won't go into the detail, but I can tell you it was an immensely positive evolution inside Iran. Now, sanctions have done nothing. All they've done on Iran since 1979 is they've made it into an independent country. And yes, there are medicines you can't get in Iran, and people are dying. They're Western medicines as a result of those sanctions. But you go to Iran, it's absolutely astounding how they do things for themselves. And this is a pretty prosperous country. Sanctions have done nothing. Yes, there are still sanctions on Cuba. The USA can't forget that there was a revolution in Cuba. And I say to your listeners, 1959 was when America put sanctions on Cuba, and hasn't changed a thing there. And if America wants to change Cuba, take my advice. Remove the sanctions immediately, and within 2 years, you'd have probably got the government overthrown in Europe. But the American government, if I may say so, is not only petty and vindictive, it doesn't understand the sanctions. But in respect of Iran, although that spokesman is still, I think, represents American interests, Europe could well be saying now that things have to change. And recognizing that Iran is giving a leadership, recognizing, frankly, that Europe and its backing of Israel and its backing of American policy, all of which is an absolute failure now. There's no morality left in European and American policy. There's no political principle left. And as that is so, so you're getting this shift and people saying, well, we do have to start talking to Iran, a country which has attacked nobody knows how many hundred years. So sanctions are not working. They are, and as pointed out by the Iranian foreign minister, I think there were 200 or 300 of those, what they call those revolving cylinders, centrifuges, were a while ago, and that now there's 20,000 of them. And if sanctions continue, maybe there will be 40,000 of them. I mean, Iran is not saying that, and it doesn't actually need any more. But face up to it. Sanctions have got nowhere. They're only where because the Americans' frankly policy is controlled by Israel, and Israel hates Iran because that and Hezbollah in Lebanon and Assad are the only forces which openly and publicly stand up against Israeli expansion. So I'm crossing my fingers in the hope that there will be a deal between the P5 and 1 and Iran, though given the American history and the fact they're controlled by Israel, I'm not going to bet on it at the moment. I'm just sort of sniffing the air and saying, well, maybe by the time, if I can come on your program again at some time in the future, maybe by then we'll be able to welcome the end of major sanctions against
Rodney, I must say that it is very well known. It's certainly known in Washington, where annually 16 U.S. intelligence agencies come out with basically the same assessment, saying they can find no evidence whatever that Iran's nuclear program is anything other than peaceful. There's no military component. And these are annual assessments, 16 intelligence agencies that include the CIA and the NSA. And if they can't find any evidence, you can bet you there's no evidence. No evidence exists. And Israel knows this, and Netanyahu knows it, and Obama knows it, but the policy is the opposite. I'm pessimistic. I think they're going to find a wrinkle. I think they keep raising the bar on Iran, Rodney, no matter what Iran agrees to, which is very reasonable. I mean, Iran is going way beyond what it needs to do to satisfy so-called Western concerns, you know, manufactured phony Western concerns led by Washington. And if Washington and Israel weren't involved in these negotiations, they never would be taking place in the first place. European countries would treat Iran like a normal country, but they get bullied by Washington. And you've got the Israeli situation, you know, the elephant, the hidden elephant in the room in these negotiations, and that's what's causing all of these problems. President Rouhani thinks by the end of November there'll be a deal. I certainly hope he's right. He knows a lot more about what's going on than you or I do, Rodney, but I remain pessimistic until proved otherwise.
I think you're right to be pessimistic. If you just look at what is happening, and you're right, because you can assume that the Americans are just going to go on in a stupid way, and they don't realize that everybody's, frankly, they're despising American policy. It is so bankrupt. It is so creating problems. And the same with Israel. No morality, no principle. And that when people get like this, they get hubristic, don't they? And they think that they're right, and they just carry on until they create disaster. So I can see that probably betting, I would bet with you, but my instinct is the thing is so bad now, and they've reject Russia now, that I think the thing is going to swing away, because it can. That's all it can do now is swing away from Western influence, and there may be a disaster coming, but I think a lot of people are seeing the way the wind is blowing. Let us just hope so, and hope that my little sniff in the air is an accurate sniff, and I haven't got things wrong. Steve, the Rohingya Muslims. Just as Zionist Israel can do what it likes because the Americans are backing it, and up till last week, the British were backing, but there are now big question marks over that. So the Buddhists, for heaven's sake, who are supposed to be peaceful people, have been conducting their ongoing genocide inside Myanmar. The Rohingya Muslims. Now, I really don't want to go into who the Rohingya Muslims are, because if people are born in a country and their fathers were born and their mothers were born and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers, and you go back in time, I am not interested in anything else. We're not talking about whether you were born here. We're not talking about your mother and your father and you being born, or your grandfather and your great-grandmother and the rest of it. The Rohingya have been born in Myanmar for centuries. And yet, that they're supposed to be questions of as to, well, maybe they may have come into the country 500 or 1,000 years ago. I mean, thank you very, very much. You look at the United Kingdom, and we've had all sorts of people. We had Celts coming into our land. Then we had the Romans coming in. And then we had those wicked Anglo-Saxons and the Vikings. We even had the French. Goodness me, Steve. We had the French come in and have a military victory in the United Kingdom. But all this is many, many years ago. And the sensible principle today is, on any argument, if you are born in that land, you are born in the land. We're not talking about immigration, naturalization, or buying, or anything like this. We are just talking if you were born. And that is the position of the Rohingya. And yet, they are being slaughtered. And it is racism of the worst sort. And it happens because you have an autocratic regime which is not
democratic. But because the West perceives that there are plenty of mineral resources, it's all creepy crawly time with this government, which is committing a genocide. And you don't hear a word about it in the Western press, not on any of your media that I can find out. It's only on some of the alternative stations. So a word to listeners, the Rohingya Muslims, it's quite disgraceful. And just as the West turned a blind eye to what Israel got up to. And by the way, didn't Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, get a shock when he actually visited Gaza and said, goodness me, I didn't believe it was like this at all. And yet he didn't really raise a hand against the Israeli onslaught when it was actually happening. But you're getting the same sort of thing in Myanmar, and nobody knows about it, let alone and Ban Ki-moon. So that's one to look up. It's shameful, and it's being done because the West basically wants to make deals. But they should stand up and show some moral backbone in the world. But because America is showing none, Israel is showing none, and I don't want to hear any American politician ever again talk about American values. I mean, everybody's now laughing at them. And look what happens in a place like Myanmar. Okay, so that's the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar in a dire plight, and my country and your country is prepared to do nothing about it.
A very sad situation, Rodney. I have mentioned this, I think, briefly in a couple of articles, but I haven't written a separate article about it.
Yes, yes. Well, it's one of those things in which information is difficult. But Burma has many small peoples, as it were, and there are have been tensions. But basically, the Rohingya are being used simply as scapegoats, and it's not as though they're an immigration people. They've been there for hundreds of years, so it's racism of the worst possible sort. Now, Steve, I want to turn, if I may, to what I think is a major subject in its long-term implications. It's the subject of the negotiations over the specific, by Pacific I mean ocean, Pacific trade partnerships, with which America is involved, and the one between America and the United Kingdom. Because in these negotiations, you're getting an extreme version of that arrogance which came into the world in roughly 1991 and was then expressed in that book, The End of History, by Francis Fukuyama, the American academic. By the end of history, it simply said everything is perfect politically, everything is perfect economically, and this thing called the, quote, free market, quote, is free, efficient, and just now. That supreme arrogance then got accentuated by certain developments, including the getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act in the USA, the development of computer trading, in which the big banks can simply manipulate the thing and rip off money left, right, and center, and certain other factors which I haven't time to go into. But that arrogance now imbues those negotiations. And as a result is, the negotiations are predicated on the principle that capitalist entities, and by that is meant the big global corporations, not mom and pop in the local high street. But the big entities are wonderful, and everything they do and everything they want will be to the advantage of not just themselves, but to everybody else. A greater lie there could not be. In the USA, those big entities, for example, have got rid of between 5 and 7 million jobs. And as you, on the grounds that as long as the products are made cheaply, the American public will have cheap goods. But as you and I well know, and as listeners well know, the buying power from the jobs which have been exported, that buying power is now out of the economy, a point well understood by Henry Ford, who said, you can't make things unless you've got the buying power to actually buy them. Well, that situation now is being brought into being in these negotiations, in which these big companies will be able to go to secret tribunals and allege anything which they perceive as affecting their, here it comes, expected profits. Expected profits is a number which you get hold of your computer and you press 1 and 0000, you put a few commas in, another 000, another 000, and those are my expected profits. And they can then sue against anybody, including governments, who in any way upset their expected profits. This is not just a complete control of the corporations. It is, in fact, the end of all, for example, all environmental legislation. I mean, the tobacco people have been having a bad time, except in places like Indonesia, where they're getting the whole population smoking cigarettes if they can. But they'll be back in business, because they will be able to sue for their expected profits and against all this environmental legislation, which means that people are being discouraged to smoke. So, Steve, this thing is going on, and we are being bullied and browbeaten into it. But, believe my words, the overall effect of this thing will be to hand over power from governments to these corporations. It will be who will then dominate the governments. And that combination of spying and power in the hands of a few corporations, you could say that the military-industrial global finance complex will be coming to dominate the world. And we've simply got to oppose these negotiations. They hand power to a small group of entities whose interests are only in themselves, and they care nothing for the economic well-being of the mass of the population.
Yes, indeed, absolutely. Big issue.
Yes.
We have 6-7 minutes or so left, Rodney. I don't know what you've left out from your list, but maybe you can cover the rest of it, and maybe we'll finish the entire list before the hour is up.
Well, we've got through most of what I wanted to deal with. I think the big ones, I've covered that. The trade partnership I wanted to bring in towards the end, Rohingya Muslims, and sanctions against Cuba. Now, a word on Cuba. Cuba is a country which has suffered badly from sanctions. It's right next to the USA. But have you noticed on the Ebola subject, because it wasn't on my list, I said it wasn't going to be on, but I would like to take the chance, that Cuba is actually sending doctors, and there are question marks as to why the USA is selling soldiers, soldiers into areas where there is Ebola. But I want to refer here to Dr. Randy Short. Randy came on a program with me 3 or 4 weeks ago, and that was about the killing. In the USA, you're always killing people with guns. By the way, we do it in our police stations. I've been horrified at the figures in the UK. We do it. In our police stations, you get all these unexplained deaths, actually in the police station. But anyway, Randy was talking about the killings. And on the subject of Ebola, he then turns up in a program on Press TV. And to my astonishment, he produces a bit of paper, which he waves. And this has gone viral, this piece of information. And, Steve, I want to know what you comment on this or what your listeners comment on it. Randy, when he was talking about Ebola on Press TV, he produces this piece of paper, which is a copy of a patent on Ebola. And it is, I believe, it's owned by the American government. I'm not sure about that. But certainly the ownership of the patent is somewhere in the USA. Now, I've been trying to work that one out. Okay, but why do you put a patent on something like Ebola? And I have to say now that unless a clear explanation comes round out and an explanation is given, a lot of people are going to be very, very suspicious of how Ebola is coming into the scene. And I'll say this bluntly. People are saying, are wondering whether it is a race-specific thing, whether it has been engineered, and that the effective of the thing will be that it's ultimately about population control, and it's about knocking out, knocking out black people, and that will be the long-term consequence. Anyway, so Steve, do you or listeners have any thoughts as to why a patent on Ebola is owned in the USA?
I am very suspicious about what's going on in the Ebola situation, Rodney. I haven't written an article about it. I've mentioned it briefly, I think, in at least one article. But I think it's a combination of, on the one hand, wanting to come up with a possible bioweapon, as you mentioned, for population control. And we're talking mainly about Africa. I don't think they want to decimate U.S. cities or other Western cities. And I think Big Pharma is involved. And when you come up with whatever is involved to create something biological, you get them involved. So we're talking about potential big profits for the big drug companies. I think this is what the Ebola thing is all about. I don't think people in Western cities should panic that, you know, you need to go out in protective gear or have it help you. I don't think that's the situation at all.
No, I don't think there should be a panic, but I mean, in Western cities. But, you know, the question is being raised as to whether it is something which is being thought up for Africa. I mean, Steve, we mustn't forget that that there was a weaponized anthrax, which at some stage, was it 2 or 3 years ago, was appearing in the situation. That this weaponization of bioweapons goes on. And I can tell you now that there's no doubt that these Israelis are into weaponization of genes, that of diseases, though they've got a big problem. If you talk about the Semitic genes, the Semitic genes are actually owned by the Palestinians, and there have been studies on this. The genes of the Israelis are largely European, so they'd better watch it when they start doing their bioweapons. Those weapons will come home to hit them and hit Europe as well, and the Europeans won't like that for a start. But on the Ebola one, Steve, I think we mustn't aggravate the situation or propose panic, because it won't do any good at all. But I can tell you now, there are question marks out there, and there is this question of why anyone should patent the Ebola virus and want to try and get control of everything do it. I mean, fighting it, finding a remedy against it, that seems to me to be thoroughly creditable. Though, isn't it interesting, they hadn't done much work on it, had they, because there was no money to be made.
And when there's money to be made, they always find other money to be invested to make more money, Rodney. But I smell a rat in the whole business. And, of course, the Ebola story keeps making headlines on a daily basis. you could have other health situations that simply would not rise to the level of the headlining of Ebola. So, I mean, something rotten is going on. And I suspect that maybe it's something along the lines of population control and the drug companies wanting to get their dirty hands on another big profit center, and I think they smell one with Ebola.
There is that thing. It's Agenda 21, and it has been part of all sorts of think tanks in the world. And one wonders some of the strange things which are going on. Whether there are policies which are racially biased to control a world population. A quick one there, Steve. My view on population is quite simple. It's that if you ensure that everybody has productive capacity and the associated income, and they feel stable, then they all end up voluntarily controlling themselves, and the population stabilizes or all goes backwards. In Europe, it has happened. As soon as you get middle classes and people who feel stable, immediately they go back to having less than 2.2 and down to even 1.9. It's happened in Russia. It's happened in the middle classes in places like Kenya. It happens. You only need to have a degree of status with women. And once you get that economic security, you see, it's the insecurity, which means you have to have lots of children who then look after you in your own age, old age. So this population control is a vicious thing, and it ignores the responsibility. Its assumptions are that we can never, ever allow people to have economic security and a reasonable standard of living. We have to hog it all to ourselves and kill everybody else. Those are the assumptions of those who worry about the population.
You and I know that
the population can stabilize itself. Sorry, Steve, you were going to say.
Yeah, we're out of time.
Yeah, okay.
The hour flew by, Roddy. I look forward to getting you back last month. I would only mention in closing that Henry Kissinger, about 40 years ago, I recommended population control, eliminating millions of unwanted eaters. I think that was the language or something like
unwanted
that.
Unwanted ears. What a phrase.
What a phrase. Unwanted eaters, you know, using up resources
for eaters, profit. Yes.
Roddy, next month we will continue this. A marvelous hour. Many, many thanks to my listeners. Okay. Join us again. Make this program a regular habit.